It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and Let's Talk Legal.
And Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240, with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins in the studio. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
What are we talking about today?
Well, I was here a couple of weeks ago. I missed last week. I had to be in Kinston for some court-related stuff. But, you know, a couple of weeks ago was the first program of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So time moves on, and we were talking about timing as it relates to
right.
litigation. So we're going to pick back up on that today. And what we talked about primarily during that first show or meeting mm-hmm. here on a Tuesday morning of the year was timing as it relates to statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we really got into that, not into a lot of detail with regard to different claims, but just talked about it in general, how, you know, you can't kind of sit on your rights.
Right.
And statute of limitations, you know, as it relates to claims. Usually you're talking about a 3-year from the date of incident if it's like a breach of contract or negligence
mm-hmm.
type claim. There are different types of statute of limitations.
There's a lot.
There's tons of them, depending on the circumstances. So, you know, we talked about that a lot, but, you know, kind of moving to other issues of timing in the world of litigation and lawsuits,
mm-hmm.
That's just the way we live, you know, really. You know, everything is on a clock. You know, everything has got timing. You know, a lot of times when we're dealing with a lawsuit, we have a discovery scheduling order. We have an order that's put in place by the court so that certain things have to be done by a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the event they aren't done, then there's usually, you know, some pretty serious consequences. You know, for example, you may have in your discovery scheduling order the date by which any expert witnesses have to be designated.
That, mm-hmm.
Now, that's a pretty important issue because, you know, if you have a case where experts need to be designated, let's say it's a medical malpractice case, or let's say it's a case that's a, you know, even a guardianship where maybe a neuropsychologist is evaluating the person.
Right.
Right. So, you know, obviously we want both sides, plaintiff and defendant, to have the opportunity to depose the other expert
mm-hmm.
on the other side. So if you don't disclose that expert in a timely fashion, then sometimes you don't have that opportunity. So it's, you know, I've certainly been in cases before where opposing counsel has failed to designate their expert in a timely manner or tries to, at the last second, put on expert testimony from someone. And
mm-hmm.
if you have a discovery scheduling order, as it relates to that, and even sometimes if you don't, like if you do discovery request, and in those discovery requests, you're asking for the designation of the expert, and that never happens.
Right.
But then at trial, you try to put on this testimony, then, you know, as I was saying, and I've been in many cases before where I've had to object and move to strike and or not allow the expert to testify. And in almost every case, if you don't comply with the discovery scheduling order and the timing
mm-hmm.
in that order, then the court's not going to allow that expert witness to testify because it's unfair to the other side.
Yeah. You know, this is where it's helpful to demystify the law because we're so influenced by what we see on TV. And there's an expert witness that's called on TV, seems to take everybody by surprise. But in reality, the discovery process, you should be able to talk to these witnesses ahead of time, right? I mean, to pose the expert witness.
Right. In the real world, the expert witnesses are designated months and months and months before they ever sit on the stand and testify.
Mm-hmm.
And before they ever sit on the stand and testify, their depositions are taken. So we have a transcript of what their opinions are. So we're not surprised at trial. In the event that, you know, their testimony changes from their deposition
or evolves,
then we have our, we have that deposition transcript, obviously, that mm-hmm. we can, attack their testimony with because they're changing their story now. So in the real world, yes, these wheels of justice move pretty slowly.
And hovering around all of these issues, Ben, even the expert witness issues, are is just the need for information to be accurate.
Right.
documents need to be found and located. They don't need to be 10 years old. Witnesses' memories fail.
Mm-hmm.
Expert witnesses need the most recent information that we happen to be able to have in a case,
mm-hmm.
so that they can appropriately render an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Circumstances, we can just go on and on here. Circumstances on the roadway, the road may change if it's an accident case, for instance. If it's a construction case, the photographs, the more closely tied they are to the event,
right.
to the defect,
right.
the better. So what's going on here basically is that the law is going to do everything it can, including these time limitations during the course of the trial,
mm-hmm.
like, for instance, designating an expert witness. The law is going to do everything that it can in order to attempt to bolster the truth,
mm-hmm.
and accurate information. And so that's the rationale behind time limitations, or certainly statutes of limitations. Now, as to the actual deadlines that Wes deals with in the course of the litigation, the discovery deadlines, the motion deadlines, things of this nature, litigation is extraordinarily precise, and the court, we've talked about this before on the program, there's
mm-hmm.
a narrowing of issues all throughout the discovery process, all throughout the motion process, so that when the matter finally gets to court,
mm-hmm.
it is just that very precise issue potentially that is, before the court. Not all of the, everything and anything that we can find.
That's right.
That's going to be confusing and overwhelming, and the court isn't going to allow that.
Right. So, yeah, back to Tommy here in a moment, but just to touch on what Cecil said, yes, when you get to trial, you've basically narrowed those issues, and then you try to determine what those issues are. Well, the issues are normally set forth in the pleading. It's not just a free for all when you get to court. I mean, most people have heard, if you've watched Law
right.
and Order
sure.
years ago, Perry Mason, objection,
yeah.
relevance,
right.
that kind of stuff. Well, a lot of times when you're dealing with relevance or things that are not dispositive as it relates to the issue at hand, then the court is wanting you to focus in on what the issues are, and that starts and begins with the pleadings, meaning the complaint that you file, or if you're a defendant, the answer that you file to the complaint. So you see what the gripe is about. And the court really wants to keep you within the box of that gripe.
Mm-hmm.
So back to...
Because the common expression on TV is you can't go on a fishing expedition or something in court. Fishing is done ahead of time.
And let me mention that. Believe it or not, fishing expedition... is, here we are in Carteret County fishing. the fishing expedition is actually stated in cases.
Mm-hmm.
We have multiple cases that talk about the extent of discovery, and it won't allow a party to go on a fishing expedition, meaning, you can't just throw your hook out there and see if you find something. But the standard, and this is really a discovery standard, is when you're going through discovery and you're looking for maybe bank records, or you're looking for
right.
Medical records, whatever it may be, what you're looking for in discovery has to be reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. That's the standard.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to have some correlation between what you're asking for and the issue. You can't just hope to find something that maybe this person did that we can get them on.
That's
that kind of thing.
That's right.
Yeah. So back to the timing, it starts right from the beginning of a lawsuit. You file your lawsuit. The court issues a summons. That the complaint and the summons need to be served within the 90-day period of time. And sometimes that's an issue. Sometimes you can't find the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the sheriff is having a difficult time getting them served. Sometimes we don't know their address. But lawyers have to be very cognizant of that, because once that 90 days runs from the summons that was issued by the court, it expires. So basically, if you file your lawsuit within the statute of limitations, but barely within the statute of limitations, and then you let that 90-day period run without having it served, you have to get a new summons issued. That's where your statute runs
right.
from.
Right.
So, however, if you're within that 90-day period of time, you can get extensions of the summons in perpetuity until you get them served. So you preserve your statute of limitations. So you can see how
right.
complex right from the beginning this timing becomes. You have to be, you know, on top of this at all times. Otherwise, you can create problems in your client's case.
All right, we'll take a break, and we'll come back with more here on Coastal Daybreak and Let's Talk Legal. If you would like to call in with your questions, you can call Kenzie, and she'll answer at 800-818-2255 or these local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
And we'll be back with more from Let's Talk Legal right after this. Back to the program here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. Thanks for joining us at 7:46 in the morning. Good to have you with us as we're with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins on Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law and Let's Talk Legal. We're talking about time.
Right.
I've heard a legal term, and just tell me if this takes place. Is tolling? Is that
tolling, right?
Is that when you preserve that?
That's right. Yeah, you can enter a tolling agreement. I mean, sometimes if you have a case that, you know, for some reason you're not ready to file it yet, but you're talking with the attorney on the other side, you can enter a tolling agreement where mm-hmm. the statute of limitations will just be held in abeyance, so that even in the event that the statute would otherwise run, it would be tolled, it would be, you know, held.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like, you know, oh, we might settle this case. We need to get this more information. I don't want to go through the work of having to file this lawsuit quite yet. Can we enter a tolling agreement? That's just an example mm-hmm. of tolling.
Okay.
Yeah. So
it just sort of pauses everything.
It's a pause button.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of listening to myself talk here. It seems like I always make things a little bit more technical than the flavor of the show usually. And I think the reason that I do is because the stuff that I deal with is just that way.
Mm-hmm.
The court is a little technical, and you know,
oh, we break it down.
We break it down okay. But, you know, I guess it's that way, and it kind of presents that way because, you know, lawyers have to deal with it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, you go to law school to learn to do all this stuff, and you practice to learn to do all this
right.
stuff. But, you know, trying to break it down, talking about the timing here, we were at the point where we talked about the filing of the lawsuit and the service of the summons and making sure you do it within the 90 days. And if not, getting that summons issued, extended through an AMP and some alias in pluris summons. That's more technicality there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and then just the timing just continues. The time, the deadlines keep continuing. So you file your complaint, you get it served. Well, now the defendant's in a position where they have a responsibility to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, depending on the type of case it is, but normally in state court, it's a 30-day period of time. In federal court, it's a 20-day period of time. You can normally get an extension on that within the time frame. If you let the time run, you normally can't get an extension.
Hmm.
So, but if you're within the 30-day period of time and you may apply for additional 30, then you will almost surely get an additional 30. So you have to file your response to these pleadings, to these allegations within that period of time. If you don't do that, then the court may enter default against you. And
mm-hmm.
what that means is that you didn't respond to these allegations against you, Mr. Defendant, at the time or within the time frame of responding, which would be the 30-day if you did not get an extension. And I've confirmed, the clerk has confirmed that that took place. So we're going to enter default, and the entry of default is just a document that the clerk would put on record, prepared by the attorney for the plaintiff normally, that basically just indicates there was in fact a failure to respond. So the effect of that is an admission of all those allegations.
Right. Right.
And that's pretty serious. So then you get to the point where, because there's an entry of default, the plaintiff's attorney then usually makes application to the court for a default judgment, meaning, okay, I got my entry default. Now, court, look, they've admitted everything in my complaint. They haven't responded. So now I'm looking for a default judgment. So what do you have to do at that point in time? Well, you have to serve your notice. You have to know what kind of motion it is. It's a mm-hmm. dispositive motion. So in most cases, you have to do 10 days, a 10-day notice. There's more time.
Another clock
That's
starting.
Right. At least 10 days. In the event you serve the defendant with this notice by mail, then there's the mailbox rule, which is 3 additional days. So that gives us 13 days. So you have to know about that. You have your hearing on that. In the event if it's a non-dispositive motion, for example, let's say a motion like a motion to compel discovery mm-hmm. or a motion for something that doesn't dispose of the case, then it's a 5-day period of time, which under the mailbox rule would be 8. So you see it's just time after time after time.
Right.
You've got to be on top of these numbers. And
does the defendant still have an opportunity to respond during that period?
Yes, that's a great question. Once there's an entry of default, once there's an entry of default, they're not in a position to be able to file an answer. Mm-hmm. They can't file an answer. They can, but it's of no effect.
Mm-hmm.
However, the standard for setting aside an entry of default is very low. So let's say there's an entry of default and then there's a motion for default judgment, but that motion for default judgment, we've given 10 days notice. So during that period of time, let's say if the defendant gets a lawyer, what they're going to do is they're going to file a motion to set aside the entry of default. Very low standard for that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then hopefully for the defendant, the court would then set aside that entry of default and we'd be back to square one.
Oh,
then
really?
You can go ahead and file your answer.
Okay.
Okay. So, you know, a lot of moving parts with regard to that. But let's pause just a second and talk about what if the plaintiff in this situation doesn't give the requisite notice.
Mm-hmm.
I've had that happen before, well, multiple occasions, but one case comes to mind on a default judgment. The default judgment was entered against my client, and my client kind of rested on her rights and then got in touch with me later on about all this. Mm-hmm. Was kind of embarrassed about it and didn't think it was as serious as it was. And it was really serious.
Mm-hmm.
So we filed a motion to set aside the default judgment and the entry of default. Just to start over, basically. And the judge was totally not inclined to do any of it. The mm-hmm. judge said, well, you should have responded. The rules are what they are. You didn't do what you were supposed to do. The court was right entering the default judgment.
So move that standard a little higher.
Well, yeah. Why, Mr. Collins, should I just give your client a free pass? Well, my response to that was because notice was not proper on the default judgment motion because opposing counsel served my client 12 days
mm-hmm.
before the hearing, and they served her by mail, and you had to give her 13.
Right.
So they messed up on their motion for default judgment,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to take advantage of that failure to adhere to the timing requirement.
Mm-hmm.
That's how important that is. So all this had been done, entry of default, default judgment. We are way down the path here on this lawsuit. It basically was over.
Mm-hmm.
And simply because the attorney on the other side missed the notice by one day, the court felt as though he had no choice but to set aside the default judgment and kind of give us a free pass to go forward because the simple issue of the timing requirement not being adhered to.
All right. Well, there's more to come in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, here on the Talkstation. And you're still invited to call in with your question. We'll try to get to it if we can in the last few minutes here on Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins. Find information also online at harbellandcollins.com. And welcome back as we're trying to demystify the law and all the concerns around the statute of limitations again with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us.
So we're talking about, you know, the timing as it relates to all these issues in lawsuits, and we were talking about default judgment and entry of default and how the fact that the defendant really has to respond in a timely manner to a complaint being filed against them. So anyone, you know, listening needs to recognize that, you know, when you get that yellow piece of paper in the event you've been served that indicates a civil action has been filed against you.
Oh, it's truly a yellow card?
Yeah, you must respond within, it usually has 30 days or 20 days, depending on the circumstances on it, then, you know, that's serious. You have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to file a response to that. And it's basically an admit or deny the allegations. You need to, you know, in most cases, probably have an attorney, depending on what kind of case it is. So the timing with regard to that is very important. And I know we only have like 3 or 4 minutes left. And so you know, kind of moving on a little bit here from just the timing as it relates to response to the complaint to other issues. Well, then when you're in the lawsuit, you're moving forward probably with discovery at that point in time. Well, timing is important in general with regard to that because you can't wait too long to do discovery. This is kind of a general guideline because in the event your discovery is not done and the case is called for trial and you waited too long to get this process started, the court won't like that very much. If, for example, the case is put on for trial and you're asking for a continuance, and the reason you're asking for continuance is because you don't have all the medical records yet, or you don't have all the bank records yet, or you don't have all the, you know, whatever discovery it may be. Well, the judge is going to ask you, well, Mr. Collins or Mr. whomever the attorney is, well, when did you serve your written discovery to get these things? Well, it better not be
last week.
It better not be last week, and it better not be 6 months after the lawsuit was filed. It needs to be, you know, we filed the lawsuit, we got a responsive pleading, our answer. And then, you know, within maybe 30 days, 45 days, we put our discovery together and got it served. So we're moving this thing along.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, an important issue. Sometimes as cases move forward, you need to file a motion to amend your pleadings, maybe amend your answer, maybe amend the complaint. Mm-hmm. And remember the pleadings. This is where the issues come from in the case.
Yeah, we've characterized this in the past. In fact, when we first began the show, it's a big funnel.
That's right.
And so you may be amending that to narrow it down, right?
To narrow it down, or you may have learned of a new issue that you need to plead. Mm-hmm. If you didn't plead it, then you can't put on evidence about it, you know, at trial. So the further down the line you are in the case, and the further you are, the closer you are to the actual trial of itself, the less likely it is that the court is going to allow you to, or grant you a Rule 15 motion to amend.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to act with reasonable expediency when you learn of whatever issue it is you need to amend for. So there's, you know, another general timing thing.
Again, this refining of the issues so that, you know, almost like a telescope, you know, focusing in, binoculars, focusing in, so that when we finally get to the court, and let's keep in mind, 12 people, really maybe as many as 13, 15, and, you know, all of the energy activity that goes into a jury trial. I mean, the lawyers, you know, have got to be ultimately prepared, and the case needs to be very in focus at that point for the jury. It can't just be, you know, all over everywhere with any kind of issue, with any kind of witness, with any kind of document.
You have to bring along, especially a jury trial, you got to bring along people who haven't been involved.
Correct.
They don't know this.
It has to be focused.
And if you have more questions, you can call on the folks at Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Just find them at 1107 Bridges Street in Moorhead City, 726-9050.